Well, this morning, as is our tradition here at Vox, we value just the work of the people. And that's even for the homily, when we open the scriptures, we value the diversity of voices within our community. And so this morning, we're going to have Dr. Jenna Minix open the scriptures for us. So come on up, Jenna.
All right. Good morning, everybody. So I'd like to begin by taking this opportunity, and we're all here together, to ask us, so what did we feel when we first heard about the Las Vegas tragedy? So maybe just take a moment and kind of reflect back on that, and you don't have to share, but if you want to just call out a word that describes how you felt. Well, I'm sure we have a lot of common feelings in the room. Anyone just want to call one out? Numb.
Anger.
Inevitable. What?
Inevitable.
Kind of like a hopelessness. Any others? Disappointment. We might have felt weary. Fear. Sad. So all of that, right? So we're collectively carrying all of that with us as we come in to liturgy this morning. And this week, a friend of mine and I, we sat down and we were processing some unrelated news that also felt really heavy, but also the Las Vegas tragedy. And my friend just commented on how it had felt like a series of difficult weeks where before that, we were processing, the fear of deportation, the separation of families that was coming close to home. Before that, we were processing, refugees that were fleeing from violence. Before that, we were processing violence against women that we face every day. Before that, violence against the LGBTQ community. And what my friend and I were doing in that conversation is we were trying to gain perspective on what does a helpful response really like even look like when we're wounded, and especially like when the wounds just feel like they keep on coming. So if you can relate to that feeling, if you've had a series of hard weeks or hard months or hard years, and it just feels like it keeps coming, welcome. Welcome to liturgy. You are welcome. We welcome the parts of you that feel weary, the parts of you that are struggling with questions. And I don't believe that there are one-size-fits-all formulas, but I do believe that these questions of like, what does a helpful response look like? I believe those are the appropriate questions for us to be exploring together. And we follow the lectionary most of the year, and the text that just happened to be assigned for today is a story about human violence and this fascinating way that Jesus responds to it. And so my goal is that we'll leave here today, like actually with some helpful, workable things that we can experiment with to provide some care for ourselves and each other and the world. So if you're with me, let's dive in. So I invite us to read together Matthew 21, verses 33 through 41, aloud to one another. All right, so a little background here. So we see Jesus often speaks like this, like in parables and stories, when he's trying to tell dangerous truths to powerful people. And in fact, just a few days after this, we will discover that he's arrested and killed by some of the very people he's telling this story to. And so on one level, this passage we just read is Jesus saying to these religious leaders, like, I know you're about to kill me, and I'm not planning to stop you. So I think this is important to understand here because like these are Jesus's enemies and they're violent people who mean him harm. And we too will have enemies. So Jesus says to love our enemies, which means we will have them. And so when people mean us harm or harm to our loved ones, I don't think it's really helpful for us to pretend that we're not enemies. And so I'd like to invite us this morning, as we begin to explore this story, to maybe allow like our minds to be thinking about people or groups of people that we find ourselves in like an enemy relationship with. Like for me as a woman, it might be people who perpetuate violence against women, or, you know, people who hold racist beliefs, or people who exploit the vulnerable. And so whoever those like groups are for you, I think that recognizing our own personal enemies will allow us to enter this story from a place of insight. Because Jesus here, so he's speaking to people who mean to harm him, his enemies, and he's like telling them a parable, which is shocking for like what he's not doing, which is he's not, you know, plotting a counterattack or like armoring up with weapons. He's not doing any of that. So instead, he tells them this little parable about a group of hired tenants who were not doing their job. And it's one like last attempt to get through to the religious leaders. Like, you've been given a job to do and you're not doing it. Like, you're not caring for the poor and the vulnerable. And he tells them this little story about the tenants who were hired to harvest grapes and share them with the vineyard owner. So here's, this is like a centuries old illustration of this parable. And it's a little gruesome because when the owner of the vineyard sends his servants to go collect the grapes, rather than sharing the harvest, the tenants decide to just kill the servants. They seize the servants, they beat one, they kill one another, they kill another, and they stone another. And then the owner sends his own son over, and they decide to kill the son too. They seize him, they throw him out of the vineyard, and they kill him. So there's a social model that explains the destructive roles we slip into when we're in conflict with one another. You may have heard this referred to as the drama triangle. And here's how this tends to play out. So it often begins with someone who's wounded or afraid they're going to be wounded, because our brains don't really tell the difference. And so that person may start out in what we could call a victim position. And then the person who did or said the wounding may start out as being seen as the persecutor, which is kind of a funny word. So when our kids were little and their cousins were little, we taught them this model. And so we would have four-year-olds running through our house being like, "Stop persecuting me." And it was funny. But what usually happens is this. The person in the victim position usually does something back to the persecutor. And it usually feels right and justified. It feels like I'm just trying to teach them a lesson, or like let them feel why what they did was wrong. And what that does then is it allows the original victim and persecutor to essentially just swap places, right? And so then they'll just keep this up. Usually they'll keep it up indefinitely until a third person like comes in and joins. And then that person may start out in the rescuer role. But the rescuer essentially usually ends up becoming another persecutor, which just produces another victim, and the violence just keeps continuing. So they just keep revolving around the triangle. And triangles are one of the most stable structures we find in the universe. So they can withstand a tremendous amount of force from the outside, and they don't collapse. In fact, external pressure just makes a triangle stronger. So in my opinion, this helps explain how violence spreads through the world and how we contribute to it without even realizing it. So here's a personal example that might help make this a little more concrete. So this summer, I was at a public pool here in East Austin. And I was waiting for one of our other middle school parents, Sam, because we had planned this. Zaman is our middle school and high school group. We planned an outing. And I got in there really early. And so I was waiting, and I was laying on the grass. And while I was waiting, a group of school children, a large group of school children and their teachers arrive. And so the pool staff checks them in. And the school children and their teachers happened to be the only Black guests at the pool that day. And there were about 30 of them. And the pool staff checks them in, and the kids get into their suits, and they all jump in the water, and they start playing. And I was relaxing on the grass, and I remember so clearly how happy everyone looked and how what a good time everyone was happening. And I was just waiting for Sam to arrive. Well, after a little while, there was this incident involving one of the littlest of the group of school children. And it ended up being very minor, and even though it ended up okay, the incident scared the pool staff such that they felt like it was necessary to pull all of the Black kids out of the pool and have them stand against a wall. So this is a 50-year-old photograph that gives you some sense of just how the scene felt, except there were about 30 kids standing against the wall, and they were in bathing suits, so very vulnerable. And the kids and the teachers received, as I was watching all this play out, the kids and the teachers received no explanation from the pool staff, who happened to all be white, as to why they were being pulled out of the pool. Like, why all the other kids in the pool who happened not to be Black that day were allowed to stay in and keep playing. So this is a really heavy story. So just take a deep breath with me right now. I'm describing as it played out as I was witnessing it. Now, my best guess is this, that the pool staff had suddenly become afraid that they'd admitted too many guests into the pool and that they were understaffed. And they were like trying to sort all this out. But that doesn't change how the scene felt. And the white pool staff seemed completely unaware of the generational trauma that was being recreated as they were trying to figure this out. And so some of the kids started crying, and some of the teachers got real stoic and would just go stand next to a kid and say, "Don't cry, don't cry." So I'm going to tell you what was going on internally inside me when all this was playing out. I'm looking at Sam's right over here. He heard this whole story. So as I'm scanning the faces of the pool staff for any sign that it's registering to them, like why what's going on is hurtful, I feel like heat rushing to my face, my heart's pounding, my jaw is clenched, and all these potential solutions are like running through my brain, and they all end in some form of like public shaming and humiliation of the pool staff. Like, that's what I'm fantasizing about right now. And that may seem rational, but it's not. Like, all that was coming from my brainstem producing those fantasies. Like, there was no higher level brain activity going on for me right then. And humiliation is, it only drives the problem underground. And then it comes out sideways some other way. But the fact that I couldn't think of a better solution in that moment, that's a sign. It's like a check engine light that I have slipped right into the drama triangle without even realizing it. So at that point, if I were to assume any of the positions available to me on that triangle, I would have become another part of the problem. But when we're stuck in that, it's hard to see it. Which is, I imagine, why Jesus tells stories and parables like the one he does in this passage this morning to try to help us see the roles that we fall into in the drama triangle without even knowing it. So in a moment, I'll share with you sort of how that story at the pool played out. But first, let's take a look back at our passage. So in the story Jesus tells, we could say that the tenants here, they may have started out feeling themselves to be in the victim role. Maybe they felt like there was something unfair about having to turn the grapes over to the landowner or whatever. But what they did was they quickly moved into the persecutor role when they seized his servants, beat one, killed another, and stoned another. And so they make victims of the servants. And then it makes sense that they would fear that the son would come in to the owner's rescue by taking the persecutor role against themselves. So they plan like this preemptive strike and they make another victim out of the sun. So we might pause here and just ask ourselves, like, when we find we've slipped into the drama triangle, like when I'm standing 6 feet away from the white pool staff with like violent rage inside me, like, what does a truly helpful response look like in that moment? Especially when the only solutions that occur to us are like somewhere on the violence spectrum. So we'll look at several options this morning, but I think they all start with this. I think constructive, helpful solutions all start with us regulating our own like nervous system. And in this passage, like Jesus isn't down in his brainstem. He's up here in the higher parts of his brain where like creativity and presence are, that helps us sort out our emotions and our body reactions enough to like have the presence of mind to stand in front of our enemies and tell them a story. Like that would have been a really cool solution. Like if I could say, and then I told the pool staff this really cool story that like changed their perspective about something. That's not what happened. But so here are a couple helpful questions we might ask ourselves when we're facing our enemies. Like first and foremost, what am I feeling right now? And what am I needing right now so that I can respond instead of react, right? So at the pool, I was feeling anger related to my need for my community to be a place where we see and care for each other's vulnerabilities. So I can't say I sorted that all through right in that moment, but once I did sort through those feelings, then I was in a frame of mind where I could go approach some of the teachers and I just could ask them, what do you need right now? And then I could go have that conversation, then go approach the pool staff and say, and what do you need right now? And then I could leave and I still had a lot of feelings to sort through, but I could come to a place where I could contact the city and tell them the story and make some recommendations and suggest some reparations that they might do for the school teachers and children. And, you know, all of a sudden now I'm involved, but not in a drama triangle way, and still not in the most creative way probably, but you know, we're all learning, right? We're just all learning. Okay. So if you'll hang with me, let's look at this from a few more angles. So the passage continues and Jesus finishes the story here where the tenants kill the servants and then they kill more servants and then they kill the son. And so the landowner has now been treated like a victim three times. And Jesus turns to the religious leaders and he asks them a question. He says, now, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what do you think he'll do to those tenants? And the religious leader's answer tells us that they're still stuck in the drama triangle. And they see no way out because from the inside of the triangle, we don't see any other possible solution other than this. They say, well, he'll put those wretches to a miserable death. Like, of course, when we're presented with an opportunity to respond to violence, counter violence truly feels like the right answer. And because it feels so right, we come up with all sorts of ways to explain why it's right. Like we're teaching them a lesson. We're helping them feel what it feels like. We're teaching them empathy, even though empathy is not learned that way. We think of rationales for why counterviolence is a good idea when really the truth of it is just that it feels good. It feels right. The violent energy needs to like go somewhere. The problem is then it just doesn't disappear. It just pops up somewhere else. So I learned something insightful about how violence spreads from listening to this episode of the TED Radio Hour. And they were talking about epidemiology and that the best model for understanding the phenomenon of violence is that it functions really like a communicable disease. We spread violence like we spread the flu. So in this podcast, they were speaking with an epidemiologist, someone who studies infectious diseases, and he was explaining that when we map violence, like in neighborhoods and cities, the patterns look similar to when we map diseases in that cluster in places like Bangladesh, where there are outbreaks of cholera and Ebola. And so the researcher thought, what if we treated violence the same way we treat infectious disease? So to contain a contagious disease, hired teams go into that neighborhood. There are people who could be trusted, like people who would be known or easily trusted by that neighborhood. And they provide human connection and skills, and they empower people to heal before the disease can spread. And so these researchers tried this approach where they would hear of a violent incident in a neighborhood, and they'd go and speak with the people in that neighborhood, and they would offer care and concern, and they would start to learn who was affected, who's mad at who now, who has reason to seek revenge on who needs what kind of healing and care and resources. They called these violence interrupters. And in communities where they did this, they saw up to a 70% decrease in violent killings, which is like phenomenal. Like there's nothing else has had that level of success. But friends, this is a hard teaching. It's hard to, I don't know if it's something that we can necessarily like put ourselves in somebody else's position when they've been on the receiving end of violence and like say, this is what you should do. But for us to examine, like, what would this look like for us to practice something like this? It's hard because counter violence, whether physical or psychological, it does feel so right. And so it makes sense that this was the religious leader's response. He'll put those wretches to a miserable death. Why in the world would he do anything else? There's a priest and a poet from Northern Ireland named Padraig O'Tuama, and he writes this. When I was a child, I learned to count to five. One, two, three, four, five. But these days I've been counting lives, so I count one life, two life. One life, one life, one life. Because each time is really the first time that a life has been taken. Legitimate target has 16 letters and one long, abominable space between two dehumanizing words. Jesus, I believe, is inviting us, showing us a way to humanize one another, a way to really interrupt violence in ourselves so that we can become violence interrupters. And I think one place we might begin experimenting with this is through self-examination. Like becoming super familiar with what is our own personal brand of violence inside us, because we all have one. And I think it's often hard for us to recognize. So we might ask ourselves, like, what are my own violent urges? What does my personal brand of violence look like? For me, it's so interesting to notice that when I'm feeling like violent rage, my temptation is to publicly shame and humiliate someone because I'm so sensitive to shame myself. But then that makes sense that that's the most hurtful thing I can think to inflict on someone else. So if we're having trouble recognizing like what kind of violence we're inclined towards, I bet you could just ask someone who knows you really well and they'll probably be happy to tell you. All right. So let's wrap up by looking at how this passage ends. So Jesus asked religious leaders how they thought the landowner should respond to the tenants and their violence. And the leader said, you know, kill the tenants. He'll put the wretches to a miserable death. And Jesus said, now, don't you know the scriptures better than that? He said, have you never read the scriptures? That the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. It's an incredible response. It's a profound response. It's a correction to say, no, that's not how this is going to play out. It's incredible, especially in this story where it certainly, the son in this story certainly seems to be Jesus. And the landowner certainly seems to be God. Because if then the religious leaders had been right, then if the story ended this way, God would have become the persecutor. You see? Or another way to look at this progression could be to go back to the beginning and see us as the original persecutors, and then Christ as the victim, and then God as the rescuer, who then becomes the persecutor. You see how it still keeps everyone stuck in the drama triangle. And if we thought that that was really who God was, like that God returns violence for violence, then that we would just be resigned and that would be our theology. But here we have Jesus saying, no. You've got it wrong. Have you never read the scriptures? There is a stone that you have rejected, and that stone has become the cornerstone. And it's the Lord's doing, and it's amazing. So what was that stone that they had overlooked, or that we are tempted to overlook and reject? Well, we might could say it's Christ, but then like in what way? I think the amazing thing here that's easy to miss, it may be that in Christ we learn that God can be wounded without wounding back. What do you think about that? That God can be wounded without wounding back. If that's true, then when we're violent with ourselves or others, God is not violent back with us. And it means, too, that when we are wounded, we also don't have to wound back. I think that we really need God's help with that, though, and we need each other's help. It's extremely hard, and I think that our ability to do that has a lot to do with how we care for our wounds, how we care for our pain. So I'd like to end by inviting us to consider what that might look like. So how do we care for our wounds so that they stay clean? So that they don't get infected, so that we're not run then by violent programs. And reflecting on this question, like, what does it look like? What would it look like to keep our wounds clean? I did something that I don't recommend that you do, which is that I Googled images of wound cleaning. I don't recommend that. But I did come across some helpful language. So here's a list of signs, like indicators that a wound has become infected, that bacteria has got in there and it's become infected. So like I notice, for instance, when I feel wounded and I'm fantasizing about how to shame the person that's wounded me, like I feel myself heating up. I feel more tender and irritable. I'm unable to tolerate frustration. My words and actions take on a foul odor. I become cynical. Toxic emotion spills out and drains onto other people in my life. And then if it really gets bad, like things start rotting, like there's necrosis that sets in. And the things that start rotting are things like my sense of humor, my empathy, my self-care, my compassion, my hopefulness. So here's the thing about infected wounds is they will never heal. Like, that's the nature of an infected wound. It doesn't heal. And I think that's maybe why one of the things we can learn from how Jesus models how to address his enemies is, like, he keeps his wounds clean. So I wonder if this might be a helpful way to understand the stone that the builders rejected. This may be the essence of our salvation, like the way out of the drama triangle, the way to end the cycle of violence. It may be the path to becoming violence interrupters. So if we were to think about what it means to be people who can keep our wounds clean and help others keep their wounds clean, what might that look like? I wonder, so here's some ideas. You might have some other ideas that come to you. Here's some ideas that came to me. So in times of violence, crisis, when we hear of shootings, of mass disasters, of tragedies, of interpersonal wounds, when we hear all these things, I wonder if basic wound care first just looks like us showing up. Like, lots of people have been showing up in times of tragedy. Just, we gather, we're with each other. Like, we're all together this morning. Like, this is part of wound care, is like, we showed up to be together. We pray, we grieve. Grieving is hard to do alone. It's really helpful to grieve together. We lament. We tell the story. We tell the story of the wound, and we also tell the story of the ways that we're helping keep the wound clean. We tell the story. We name the truths. We practice speaking dangerous truths. We sing. We cry. We share a meal. We laugh together. Sometimes we create art together to visually depict what's meaningful in our lives and our process. I wonder if it looks like all these ways that we say to one another when we're wounded, you're not alone. And it sometimes feels like that's not making a difference. I wonder if that is actually making all the difference. And it's not complicated, which is what makes me think it might actually be spot on. Because Christ's teachings are usually fairly simple to understand, but they're very difficult to actually do. We need each other. We need God's help to actually do them. I'd like to leave us with some final words from Father Otuma. And they're words about Jesus' response to violence. And so I invite you, as we close, to just allow these words to sort of usher us into a place of quiet reflection and meditation. So just take a few deep breaths with me now, if you would. Feel your feet on the ground. Tune into God's Spirit, who's present with us. And let's maybe just ask God's help that we could keep our wounds clean. So this poem is titled, Go to Hell. He is called to hell, this man. He is called to glory. He knows well those twisted ways and those who've lost their story. He is called to clay, this man. He is called to yearning. He has heard of hidden streams that heal those tired of burning. He's searching out those raised in hell. He wants to know the things they know. He believes in dreamland, where the ragged people go. He is called to quiet now. He is called to silence. Squat down on the breaking ground with those who've swallowed violence. He is called to anguished thoughts. He is called to flowers. To find in hell's own lonely fury that which no flame devours. I saw him on the midway path. I saw he carried two things only. On his trip to hell, this man, he is called to story. May God bless us and keep us. In the name of the Father, the grace of the Son, and the empathy of the Holy Spirit. Amen.